Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello and welcome to the Red Box Politics Podcast from The Times. I'm Matt Chorley. As we await the return of MPs to Westminster next week, in this week's episode, we look across the Atlantic and I've recorded a chat with David Charter, The Times' new US editor, who's only been in Washington for 2 weeks and has already covered massive stories, including not one but two huge court cases involving former aide Sir Donald Trump breaking on the same day. Before we come to that, a reminder that you can come and see the Red Box podcast being recorded live. We're going to be in Liverpool on September the 23rd and in Birmingham on October the 1st. For tickets to those events, go to mytimesplus.co.uk and it's open to all Time subscribers. Then, if that's not enough, we're at the Cheltenham Literary Festival, which is sponsored by The Times and The Sunday Times. We're recording a live podcast on October the 11th, and then I'm doing a show called This Is Not Normal on October the 13th. Just go to thecheltenhamfestivals.com for all the details. Right, back to this week's episode. So David Charter arrives in Washington, having previously spent 7 years as The Times' Berlin correspondent. Before that, he had 6 years in Brussels, where he wrote a book which essentially predicted that Britain would end up leaving the EU, and I talked to him about that. He previously spent 5 years working in the lobby for The Times, covering Westminster politics, so it'll be interesting to see how that compares to life in Washington. During our chat, we discuss his first visit to the White House, the difficulties of making contacts in an administration where people often suddenly and quite dramatically leave their jobs, and the prospect of Donald Trump seeking re-election next time round. But I began by asking him how a Times foreign correspondent goes about wiping his mind of all of that knowledge of German politics and trying to get his head around the crazy world that is Washington today.
That is a good question, because I was Berlin correspondent up until about 2 weeks before I became the US editor. There was no let up in the pace of news in Germany, because Angela Merkel has been pretty much in crisis ever since she just about won the election last September. And it was quite a tough call to how to divide my time between braining up on a bit of Washington and books like Fire and Fury, that maybe a lot of readers have read as well, have been part of my bread and butter, as well as obviously just talking to my colleagues who are already there in America and reading their work in The Times. And more than that, you can't really do. And it may sound a bit cliche, having now arrived in Washington, there was not a great deal I could do to prepare for the tsunami of news that hit me as soon as I arrived in this town.
And so it's probably worth explaining that you've been there now for a couple of weeks, but you've basically barely worked out, you know, how to turn the lights on, and suddenly you've got not one but two sort of big court cases engulfing Donald Trump literally on the same day.
That's right. One of them I could prepare for, because we knew that Paul Manafort was on trial. We'd covered it a bit in The Times, and There was certainly a lot of background reading to do from the American press, so that I could prepare for, and I was busily wondering what impacts the result of that trial would have on the presidency, and I was preparing background articles, only to find that just moments before the conclusion of that trial, the president's personal lawyer suddenly popped up in court in New York unexpectedly and gave an admission that brought the house down, really, that President Trump had directed him, in his words, to pay hush money to these two women. And all of a sudden, all my careful preparation and background reading on Paul Manafort had gone out of the window, even though he was convicted, and it came up. It was literally within moments. It was literally 5 or 10 minutes later. The Manafort thing paled suddenly into insignificance compared to the prospect of the personal lawyer who's been at Trump's side for over a decade signing a deal to spill the beans on goodness knows what. And all of a sudden, you know, that was the big story of the day. And that it was last Tuesday, as it happens, a day that will live long in the memory, possibly a week or more, you know, given this presidency. I had to rewrite the story, which became the splash of the paper pretty quickly. I had to rewrite it 3 times during the evening for different editions of the paper and an inside piece. I had the help of my colleague, Bo Deng, who's the other journalist in the Washington office, of course. We had to just keep topping it up as the revelations kept coming and the reaction kept coming. It's what you're in journalism for, really, for the big stories, and it was great fun.
And presumably that's something you've got to get more used to, not just the sort of the size of the news explosions, but with the time difference, obviously having been in Brussels and Berlin, the time difference doesn't play a massive part in your day. But part of the problem is with covering America is it's only just as America's sort of really getting going, things, but you know, press conferences and court cases breaking in the afternoon, that's just the point that back in London the Times is sort of going to press. So that's a sort of a whole new challenge for you to get used to.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, and it's probably a question that only somebody who's been an editor would really even think to ask, probably, because I was in the office between 9 and 9:30 in Germany. It was quite relaxed, a cup of coffee, read through the papers, take an hour or so to digest the news and think about 3 or 4 stories that I could offer for the day. Here, I've been leaving the house between 7 and 7:30 in the morning, so I can get at the desk before 8 if possible, because that's already 1 o'clock in the UK. It's with the 5-hour time difference. They've already had morning conference in London. We do a list in the evening, quite late in the evening. So not only do I get to the office around 8, in the evening, about 10 o'clock our time, we'll spend up to an hour maybe looking around the next day's. American newspapers are beginning to say on their apps what other stories may have broken after the newspaper in Britain has gone to bed. And quite frankly, all the online people have probably gone to bed as well. It's after 3 a.m. back in the UK. So we do a list of 3 or 4 things that might be running the next day, so that when we come in the office around 1 o'clock UK time and pick up, we've got a reasonable idea what might be running. Although clearly stuff breaks during the night and the office, because they've had their morning conference already, the ideas have come up in that conference to guide our day. So it's quite a busy run, you know, through to our lunchtime to get stuff ready for the first edition of the paper.
Let's sort of start trying to sort of pick through a bit what's in your massive in tray of stuff to get your head around. You mentioned about how the Paul Manafort case, who, like you said, was Donald Trump's former campaign manager. That was the case that you could prepare for because we knew it was happening, although it didn't actually relate to anything to do with the campaign. He was found guilty of financial crime, but it all predated his time of work for Trump. Then along comes the Michael Cohen case, which you didn't know about, but it far more directly involves Trump because it's to do with the spending and the paying off of two women who Trump had an affair with. You said that it paled into insignificance. How explosive actually do you think the Michael Cohen case is? Is it something that was, you know, that was the big story last week and then something else is going to come along? Or is its impact going to be felt for longer than that?
The impact impact is twofold, because there's the personal impact on Donald Trump's state of mind, his feeling security and paranoia in his own office, because this was a very close aide, whereas Manafort wasn't particularly close. He was more of a Republican operative who had offered to help. And that bleeds into the next main point, which is that Cohen, by the nature of his job and his closeness, has untold access and perhaps documentary evidence, which we know was, a lot of which was seized in a raid on his office and his home back in April, which I just think is just vastly more potentially explosive than what we think we know Manafort got to know during his, 10 weeks in charge of the campaign.
And it's worth, I think, sort of slightly pointing out, is that because these things move so quickly, and it seems like we've known about Stormy Daniels for a decade or more, you know, because stuff happened so fast. I mean, it's worth pointing out that at the heart of this story is an admission that the now President of the United States had an affair with two women who were then paid off, because it basically paid off to try and keep them quiet during the campaign, so it didn't come out then. But the actual impact of the fact of him cheating on his wife doesn't seem to have resonated as much. Is that, or at least on this side of the Atlantic, is that the case there? It's about the payoff and following the money and breaking the law, rather than the sort of the moral impact, if you like, of him cheating on his wife?
I would agree with that. I think the general sleaze case, if you like, of cheating on his wife, it's not playing so hard, and it seemed to have been forgiven, or maybe better word is overlooked, by his supporters for a long time, and we knew that already. And what's new in the last few weeks is the lengths that the Trump people, and possibly the Trump himself, went to cover it up, because they couldn't win the election just with their base, the true supporters who were prepared to overlook the affairs, but they did need the votes of swing voters and perhaps more moderate people, and also the evangelical Christian vote, and the you know, a lot of Americans do have very firm Christian beliefs, and all these people needed to be won over to make sure he beat Hillary Clinton. So there was a need to keep sleaze and inverted quiet, because there's so much news. Things that are already emerged, are already out, seem to almost be forgotten or sidelined, unless they are pertinent to the running story of the day. And I should say, Matt, that another thing that a journalist is supposed to do, really, when they arrive in a new country, as in my case, is to try and make some contacts, you know, to try and meet some people. And this is proving a little more difficult in the case of Washington at the moment, because of the way our day runs. Trying to get a lunch with someone, which is the preferred method of establishing relationships, I believe, in Westminster.
Absolutely.
it's quite problematic. You can't book a lunch with any certainty that by the time it comes round, you won't be swamped in another inappropriate Washington analogy with the latest revelations. You try and sort out something to do in the afternoon after your 6 or 7 hours of trying to make sense of the day's news. It's very exciting even for a journalist, you know, who's been around for a while, and I've done, as you say, 7 years in Berlin and 6 years in Brussels and 5 years in London in the lobby in Westminster before that. But it's still a thrill to go through the security gates of the White House, go through the press room into the little labyrinth of offices at the back where the president's trusted press team work, and say hi, introduce yourself, and then try and get to know a few people. Because it's all so cramped and confined back there, you literally, when you get up, you go up a floor to meet people on the upper level, and you can see one of the doors to the Oval Office, you know, through down a corridor. But it's just there, you know, it's right by the seat of power. It's an exciting job. It's I may have emphasized the long hours and the low pay. Did I mention that? It is a very exciting place to be.
Talking about building contacts and that sort of thing, to what extent do you think, like, the normal way of doing political journalism, like you said, you're in the lobby in Westminster for 5 years, is you'd get to know people and build up sources and contacts and that sort of thing. When you've got a president who is constantly churning stuff out on Twitter, and no amount of contacts, if you like, ever seem to know his mind in the way that he does, does that completely sort of change the way of doing the job, do you think?
I can speak with more certainty about the situation in Berlin. It's always more difficult as an outsider from a foreign news organisation trying to build contacts with politicians whose time is limited and who are most keen to speak directly to their voters, you know, their constituents. And so you're always some way down on the list as a person to spend time with, or, you know, to share top secrets and exclusives with, unfortunately. But you know, gradually you find those people. You know, it happened in Berlin. You gradually find those MPs or those advisors with a special interest in Brexit or in just British relations or whatever you're interested in, and you gradually find these people. My predecessor, Rhys Blakely, I know, and my colleague Bohr, have found that they have also, over time, cultivated people. But they, in this White House, the turnover rate is pretty high, and one day they're having coffee with someone who they think is going to be a solid contact and help them on deadline with that key piece of information, and the next day the email's bouncing back because they've packed up their cardboard box, you know. So it's a continual mission, really, to get to know who's who and see if they'll speak to you and hopefully keep their job.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
As you mentioned the B word, you brought up Brexit. But we should probably mention that while you were in Brussels, you wrote a book called Au Revoir Europe, which essentially, this is back in 2011, 2012, where you essentially predicted that Britain would end up leaving the EU. Did you put any money on that at the time?
Do you know what? I wrote the book because I thought there was a strong possibility that Britain would vote to leave in a referendum, because all the signs, to me, as a Brussels journalist, all the signs pointed to, you know, our disengagement, the very low level of understanding of Brussels that we all now are so familiar with. I did not put any money on it, however, because I still thought that somehow the political establishment would be able to win a personally, I thought the British establishment would somehow be able to win a referendum. For the purposes of the book, I went through how the referendum is lost, because there was so much evidence for it. But I think what I'm trying to say is that deep down, I never really quite believed that Britain would leave the EU, that a way would be found to stay in. And I don't know, maybe that way might still be found. You're the expert now, and pass the baton over. But it's true that in the book, it was a book about what happens if Britain leaves the EU, because I did think there was a very strong chance of it, having seen at first hand not only the British engagement that I talked about, but also, you know, the way Brussels works, it's a bit dysfunctional. The British point of view wasn't getting across as much as it used to. We were very, very much at one point removed, and actually the conceit of the book was, even if we stayed, we'd be kind of leaving sort of in an engagement sense, if you like. We've always been a bit at arm's length anyway, you know, with the rebate and opt-outs and various things. So the conceit of the book was, you know, whatever happens in the referendum, we're kind of taking leave of the main project. We never joined the euro, we never will. And what I saw in Brussels was an EU that was more determined than ever to come together around the euro. You know, to save the euro and to stick to the euro was so important to them. At the time I was there, it was all the Greek crisis, that I just thought, we're never going to be part of this. We're never going to be part of the inner core of Europe. I doubt we ever will be until you know, the euro blows apart and they probably have to start again. But that's another story.
And so having been in Berlin, where the sort of the political establishment view is that the Brexit probably not the best idea, you've arrived in Washington, where I think the view of the sort of the Trump administration is that Britain is in a good place and this was a good idea to get out of the European bloc. Is that your sense?
That's the administration line. Obviously, it's Trump's own personal feeling. You know, he's the great disruptor. He's the one who likes to, you know, throw his weight around and has this America First policy, which he saw reflected in Brexit. It was like a Britain First movement, as far as Trump saw it. The only feeling I get from the sort of rest of the Washington establishment, if you like, is it's a little bit similar to the German establishment. There's a kind of resignation about it, if you like. It's not a lot of the traditional, if you like, Washington establishment wanted to see it. There have always been some Republican voices, like Newt Gingrich, who did think it was a good idea to leave. And in fact, at one point, even offered Britain a place in the NAFTA, in the North American Free Trade Agreement. But I think the consensus view, as it was in Europe, it would be better Britain stayed, looking at it through American glasses. But I also think that there's a very strong feeling now in the White House. People like Bolton, you know, have seemed pretty favourable to Brexit, and think that Britain, it will create deeper relationships with Britain.
And what about that cursed phrase, the special relationship? We've spoken on the podcast before to Christopher May, who said it used to drive Americans mad because it was a sort of a British obsession. Is that a thing? I mean, the Donald Trump's relationship with Theresa May seems to have gone, you know, they've had a 50-year marriage in the space of sort of 18 months, you know, from hand-holding to falling out and then tweeting, and, you know, it seemed a bit better when he came to the UK. When you sit down with someone from the sort of Trump administration, the man from the Times of London, you know, is the sense they like the Brits and Theresa May?
When I've had my one sit-down so far in 2 weeks in the job, the feeling I get, you know, watching the scene is that there are a series of special relationships for the Americans. I mean, periodically, not personally between Trump and Trudeau, but clearly the Americans regard Canada as a very special relationship for obvious reasons. Trump actually has a bit of a fixation with Emmanuel Macron in France.
Yeah.
He's going to go again to Paris to watch the 100th anniversary commemorations of the end of the First World War, I should say. And there's this kind of fascination there, I think, with Macron and France going on. And then there's this weird relationship between America and Germany right now, just because of the strange relationship that Trump has with Merkel. Strange and strained, I should say. But, I would say, yeah, it's a special relationship. I don't see the special relationship.
And just because I don't want to detain you for hours, but I feel like there's a whole load of stuff that I should sort of ask you about. So let's try and run through it in sort of.
Oh, go on then. Yeah.
So let's where are we on North Korea? There was a whole, you know, that was the big thing for about 5 minutes. But North Korea, the relationship between Trump and Kim Jong-un, where's that on the current sort of top 10 of things dominating Washington?
Oh, it's in the top 10 because Trump made such a big effort, but he has now realised what people have been saying for a few weeks, if not months, which is that Kim is not really showing real signs of denuclearizing, and you better start to backpedal a bit because you're going to look foolish if you put too much store on a successful outcome. So yeah. it really is in the top 10 of issues. It is talked about a lot because it's such a fascinating development. However, it's not working out as Donald Trump had hoped at the moment.
And what about Russia? Vladimir Putin was coming to the White House. He wasn't coming to the White House, as Trump was very keen to stress. The Paul Manafort case, nothing to do with the Russian collusion. Is that, where's Russia currently in the grand scheme of things?
This is a huge issue, mainly on the other side of the aisle, because of Trump's seeming inability to accept or admit that Russian interference in the election is a thing, when it is so clearly, I think, been shown that there was a lot of interference or attempted interference in the election. It's a really big, perplexing issue that is hanging over the Trump presidency, and it's now become, the whole Russia inquiry led by Robert Mueller has become a sort of strange sort of get-out-of-jail card for Trump, who's basically saying, no one's ever found any Russian collusion by me or my campaign. There's no collusion. It's a rigged witch hunt. And this is now his mantra. Whatever else is discovered, there was no collusion with Russia, so what are they going on about? It's just the card he always plays in response to almost anything else that's thrown at him. So it's become a strange player in the ongoing drama of this whole thing. Is the fact that he hasn't been tied to it is something that he now comes back to as a, you know, as a plus point.
And just given your title is US editor and not sort of Trump correspondent, what else do you hope to do? Obviously, such a vast country, and there is more to America than Trump. And you know, presumably, the closer we get to not just elections this autumn, but the his re-election campaign, you want to get out and about and try to get a handle on his support and where it's coming from, and is it still there, and that sort of stuff. What are you looking forward to about being in America apart from just monitoring Donald Trump's Twitter account?
I'm absolutely desperate to get out of Washington and go and sample the rest of the country and what people are doing and thinking around the country. I mean, it's such a vast and amazing country that it would be crazy just to stay in Washington and get sucked into this psychodrama that everyone's obsessed with here. It would be crazy. I mean, I've got to keep an eye on the Democrats and who's trying to show themselves. So I'm sure that will very quickly bring me to these states like Iowa and New Hampshire, which are so important in the first showings of who wants to come forward for the Democrats to face Trump. So those sort of things. But really, I'd love to get off, just park the political agenda if it will let me for a few days and go and just do some of the other stories. There's the whole race issue, which is an undercurrent that is everywhere in the media and society in America, and it will be fascinating to look into that. And not just with the start of the football season and whether these footballers are going to kneel down during the national anthem in protest at black rights, but just across the piece, there are still these crazy sight of people being shot or arrested.
I mean, you're talking there about shootings. I think one of the things which Brits constantly find baffling about America, we think we're alike in lots of ways, and yet the just gun crime, the mass shootings, which seem to be sort of constant, I imagine will, you know, cross your desk endlessly in the new job. But it's one of those parts of American culture which Brits just find just completely baffling.
Yes, that's right. I mean, as you know, our talk right now was delayed because there was another mass shooting in Florida that we had to report on. And it's true that the guns and the Second Amendment are really part of the national conversation still, but that doesn't, amazingly, there's no real political imperative for action at all at the moment to make the country a bit safer on guns, it seems. And you know, that's something that fascinates me, and I want to I would love to go out and meet the communities, the schools, for example, which are arming themselves. The education secretary only the other day has said she wants to earmark a particular federal budget for schools that to buy more guns.
Wow.
For teachers. It's just a fascinating story that
yeah.
we can hope to do is just explain it to readers, try and understand the way that they Americans think about it, because it just underlines that this is a foreign country. I think Reese, my predecessor, said in his farewell piece, if they spoke German or another language here, we would definitely regard them as a very foreign people. But because they speak English, that gets a bit lost sometimes, and that's why we get often a bit bemused and confused about the way things are in this country, which that's my job, is to try and understand and explain.
Well, just before I let you go, I'm just going to ask you a completely unfair and cruel question. After 2 weeks of having been there and trying to get your head around it all, how do you think it all pans out with Trump? Does he survive? Does he fight the next election?
I'm bringing this European sensibility to a very alien situation, I think. I mean, my European sensibility, having worked in London, in Westminster, Brussels and Berlin, is that this guy's days are really numbered, and the walls seem to be closing in, revelation by revelation. It did seem a particularly damaging week for him last week. However, this country plays by its own rules, and the only way that he can be forced from office, it seems to me, is impeachment. And that's regarded as a criminal matter, but it's actually 100% political. And of course, then that depends on the control, which party has the control of Congress. And even if the House of Representatives votes for impeachment, the Senate would have to pass it by a two-thirds majority. And I believe I'm right that Nixon only resigned because he thought that he was going to lose on the two-thirds majority. So bad had things become after Watergate. But it just doesn't seem to me that there's any prospect, given the very divisive and partisan nature of politics that I've found here, that there's any prospect at all of the Senate voting by two-thirds to get rid of Donald Trump. Whilst one part of me thinks, wow, it really does seem bad for him, another part of me thinks he'll go on as long as he wants to go on. And then that's a good thing in a way, because it will leave it up to voters. It won't be down to Washington politics. It'll be up to voters in the next general election if Trump keeps to his word, and if we're to take him at his word that he'll stand again. Let me just put a quick marker down that I'm not at all sure you can really rely on Donald Trump to keep to that word, to keep to that promise.
Well, I'm glad you've only been there 2 weeks. You've already worked out that sometimes Donald Trump might say something and not necessarily mean it.
let's hope for me.
David, it's absolutely fascinating speaking to you, and I'm sure we'll talk again over the coming months and years. David Charter, thank you very much.
And that's all we've got time for on this week's Red Box podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or your Android device, and sign up to the Red Box morning email at thetimes.co.uk/redbox, ready for when it returns in September. And for me, Matt Jolly, it's goodbye.
Thank you for downloading. To discover more, head to thetimes.co.uk.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Off Air, the podcast. with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
Keep your cheese in the sink.
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh,
no, how would that go in the booth?
Badly. It would go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off air, the podcast. Now available on the Times radio app.